All right, Joel. So we seem to have eaten our weight in barbecue in the last 3 days.
Yes.
That is a literal fact. Now,
should I tell you the perfect barbecue plate order? If you're in Texas and you're getting barbecue, this is what you want. You want a 2-meat plate. You want brisket. You want a jalapeno cheese sausage. You want fried okra and some mac and cheese. That's it.
We were sitting with some Danish folks last night and trying to explain what okra was or is. And then I thought, I bet you Rosemary doesn't know what okra is either. Have you had okra before, Rosemary?
Oh, we have it. Yeah, I haven't eaten it a lot, but you can, yeah, it's in the supermarkets usually, yeah.
Does it have a taste? Can you describe what the taste of okra is for those who have been uninitiated?
It's not something that I eat often. I've tasted it, but I don't even really remember. I know that it gets, if you don't do it well, it gets slimy. That's its biggest crime. It has to be well cooked. Otherwise, it's a slimy mess.
Now, so we went to a restaurant and Joel and I didn't say anything to our waitress. It was a nice restaurant. It was a barbecue restaurant, of course. We're in Texas. But the waitress came up and immediately associated Joel with Texas, even though he's from Wisconsin, and then associated me with being an outsider. Now, I was born in Nebraska. I'm a lot closer to Texas than Joel, but I was seen as being an East Coast person. Immediately, I thought, oh my gosh, I think the Massachusetts is starting to show on me.
It's the glasses, I think.
Is it the glasses? You think it makes me look Danish?
Don't you have glasses too, Joel? I'm looking at you both.
Alex looks way too smart. That's what it is. Or they could smell the East Coast on you. I don't know what it was, but she knew right away. She's like, where are you from?
Northerner. Right.
Yankee.
Rosemary has been jet setting all over the world, and which is awesome. But when she's gone, then we have all these questions. We just kind of hold until she comes back. And meanwhile, like everything happened at LM at the same time, and Rosemary wasn't even around to ask what's going on. But let's talk about the most important one first right now, which is that in Cherbourg, France, the LM factory, 107-meter mold was broken somehow. And it's really thrown a kink into the works over at Cherbourg because there's not that many molds. It isn't like you can pull out a spare mold and start making blades. Have you heard what actually happened at Cherbourg? How do they damage this mold? And how would you damage a mold? I mean, maybe importantly, it's like, how could you damage a mold like this?
Oh, I mean, there's all sorts of ways that you can damage a mold, obviously. You can drop something heavy on it or drive something into it, or you know, that they do eventually wear out, though it doesn't sound like that's what's happened here. So, yeah, obviously, I would say, yeah, it's obvious that there was an accident of some sort that involved some sort of blunt force trauma to the mold, and maybe not blunt, maybe it was sharp, I don't know. But anyway, the mold is damaged enough that it's... It's going to take some time to repair. And when you only have, you know, one or a small number of lines of manufacturing, then that has a significant impact.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because it doesn't just impact the LM factory. People think, you know, oh, the LM factory. I've actually seen on LinkedIn a ton of the technicians from Dogger Bank, where they were supplying a lot of these blades, looking for jobs because, yes, they were furloughed. So a lot of them will come back. But some of these guys are subcontractors and technicians out there that they don't know if they'll come back, and it's getting to be busy season for anybody offshore that's a contract worker. So they're looking for projects.
Is it plausible that this is the only thing that has caused that? I mean, it's wild that, you know, like they were just, a blade was coming off the line and then being driven straight out to the wind farm to be installed. It's not normally that tight, you know. So maybe this was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, but it would be surprising to me if the blame rested solely on the shoulders of whoever damaged this mold.
Yeah, no, you're 100% correct. They had vessel issues and some other things out there. But as those things started to spool up and snowball on that project, there's a lot of people out there that are looking for work.
How do you build a mold quickly, Rosemary? Is there a way? Or do you just say, you know what, it's going to be 90 days.
There have actually been a lot of improvements in the mold manufacture because, you know, for a long time, the design, the building of the mold, the procuring of the mold was basically the critical path for a new blade designer. It used to take, say, roughly 6 months, maybe longer for such a big mold to get the mold made. And so it was always, yeah, like I said, the critical path. You had to lock in the blade geometry quite early on so that you could get the mold made. But now they are starting to use 3D printing and composites. So instead of, you know, machining the entire mold, they can, you know, 3D print a framework and then lay composites in it. And then I think that they use 3D manufacturing to you know, make the surface perfect. And that's a lot faster, but it's a huge mold. So I don't think that, you know, it's going to happen instantly. And usually the molds are not manufactured in the same place that they're needed. So, you know, I, for example, worked on a project where we were desperately waiting on our mold to arrive so that we could get started making our blades. And then it just fell off a ship in the in the ocean. And so it was a big deal. It caused some problems. So, yeah, it's, you know, stuff can happen and it takes a long time.
Wait a minute. Time out. Did that really happen?
Yeah. I was only peripherally involved with that one. So there was definitely, you know, project managers who were more bothered by that occurrence than I was. But there was, you know, the number of times that my blades on the way to site would get, you know, the truck would roll over and the blade would end up in a ditch. And you're like, okay, well, so it's one thing, we've got to get the blade out of the ditch, which is not that easy. Always in the middle of winter, of course, because I worked with de-icing. And then you've got to figure out, is it broken as well? And, you know, like when you're working with prototypes, you only have three blades.
So what happens to the mold that falls off the ship, Rosemary?
It's bobbing around somewhere in the Atlantic, I guess. That's my assumption.
That's what happens. That happens all the time. The container ships lose containers all the time. They just bloop.
If they can salvage it, they do. But most of the time, they can't salvage it. It's too deep.
So they just let it go.
I mean, it wouldn't have been in a container, obviously, but...
How much is it going to cost to make another 107-meter mold?
Several millions.
Yeah, 1 million, 5 million.
Yeah, quite a few. But I mean, bear in mind, they are kind of like a wear part, right? You do expect to replace them. So they would have brought forward the replacement of this one. I don't know by how much. I've got no idea where they're, you know, where they're at in their cycle. But it's not like you just buy one set of molds and use that for the entire lifetime of the blade when it's something that they're, you know, making so many of as this one. So yeah, it's impossible to say if it was small deal or a big deal. I mean, obviously it's not a small deal. Otherwise, if they were just about ready to replace it, then they would have the next one ready to go. So obviously they weren't expecting its life to be up just yet, but
its life is over now.
Yeah, it is interesting to think like what's happened to it that they couldn't repair it. Because, you know, if you just like dropped a hammer on it and, you know, bashed a hole, you'd obviously be able to repair it pretty well. It's not like totally straightforward because you do need to make sure that the surface is perfect. But, yeah, like I'm wondering if, like, maybe gantry just, you know, smashed down, dropped on it, and bent the whole thing in half, or, you know, it's got like total speculation, obviously, but it is amusing to wonder what happened and what the vibe in the factory was like as that was happening and afterwards. It, yeah.
The person who did it, can you come to the office, please?
Just walk out.
Yeah, you might as well. No, not in France. In France, you're good. That person still has a job.
Yeah, well, now we're going to have the same fight that we always have. It. Like, if it's possible for one of your, like, just a random manufacturing worker to cause this much strife, then there are problems higher up that, you know, there weren't the appropriate safety systems in place if one human error can cause an issue like this, then you have some, I would say, safety problems and, yeah, just general organizational problems. Yeah, process issues, like little, safety controls. So.
Well, there's 650 people that got furloughed for 3 months, so it's more than a handful now.
Yeah, I can't quite get my head around the fact that is the direct, like, that it's one-to-one, that it must have been some pressure built up, and this was the last thing that meant that it was impossible to avoid that, surely. I mean, I don't know. I'm speculating, but I just can't imagine that this on its own is enough to cause that, because there is usually some sort of slack in the system and other things that people can be doing for a little while. But I mean, if the mold truly is just absolutely destroyed and they have to just start again and there's absolutely nothing else for them to do in the factory because they've only got one line, then yeah, I guess that is going to have a big impact. But yeah, we'll probably never know.
Can we talk about something more positive than broken molds at GE or LM?
Yeah, let's talk about laying off of 2/3 of the 70% of the workforce, the global workforce at LM.
Oh, okay. Since Rosemary's raised that issue, we haven't talked about we have talked about briefly the closing of the plant in Turkey, the LM plant in Turkey. But associated with that was some significant layoffs up in Denmark. And it looked like a lot of engineering staff and professional staff in Denmark were let go. I'm not sure of the number right now. I've seen anywhere from 150 to 275. And Rosemary, you may have more of a feeling for that. What do you hear?
Yeah, I mean, I think 275 is the number of engineers that were left in Denmark after the round of redundancies, which was when I left LM. So it wasn't 275. I'm pretty sure it was more than 150. I don't want to say the exact number I've been told, because I'm not sure if I've been told something that people weren't supposed to share. I don't want to get anybody, you know, there's not very many people left there. I wouldn't want to get one of them in trouble. Yeah, so definitely huge. And it's not just Denmark, though. I mean, Denmark's the most affected because it had the most engineers there, but it's everyone in global functions. So it's spread across all of the LM locations, including other factory locations where they also have, you know, bits of engineering doing global things.
Is this the last chunk of these, or is there going to be more to come in the next few weeks? What do you think?
I don't think there'll be more to come in the next few weeks. That would surprise me. I mean, they really mishandled this if they're going to just follow this up with more cuts in a few weeks. But I do think that it seems likely that there'll be another round, in a year or two or whenever, because some of the roles that were left are people that are working on key customer accounts. And I guess that's to maintain, you know, continuity. But I could imagine that those eventually, that they would not replace those same, you know, project managers and customer managers. They might not replace them with more people in Denmark. They might replace them with people somewhere else. And so those might eventually disappear as well. It's hard to see exactly what roles have gone. I definitely, you know, I've been watching my LinkedIn and I've seen so many posts that start off with after 25, after 26, after whatever many years, fantastic years at LM. Unfortunately, my time there is over. And it's just, you know, some of these people were just some of the most talented engineers that I've ever worked with. And one in particular, my literal favorite colleague that I've ever worked with, he's been laid off. And it's insane to me because he has such a, you know, body of knowledge inside his brain that nobody else at the company had. And, you know, it's pretty rare in the industry as well to the, you know, specific projects that you've worked on throughout a career. There's lessons inside each engineer that's been, 20, 30 years in the industry. There's lessons in their brains that, you know, don't exist on paper and will just be lost. There's no way that this, you know, 100, 200 engineers that are being cut from Denmark, there's no way that they're all going to go get jobs at Siemens up the road or Vestas or, it's just like totally implausible that they're going to find more work. I think it's really, you know, a bit of a death knell for the Danish wind industry, or, you know, it's one more nail in the coffin of, you know, Denmark being the center of that, and for Europe as a whole as well. It's, you know, it's sad to me, and maybe hard to see that it's good for the world as a whole when you think about, you know, the wind's place in the energy transition, and to just lose this huge amount of knowledge that you have in Denmark. It's sad. I mean, yeah, a business can be cutthroat, but I don't know what's going to happen to all this expertise, and I hope that it's not just, you know, lost as people go out to different industries.
Yeah. What's left of LM in Denmark right now? Now that you've seen the people have left, what would you say is remains?
Well, I had an idea based on which announcements that I had seen. I mean, they've cut everything is this good starting point, right? Everyone's gone. And then kind of like, which few key roles do you need to put back? But I realized after I started messaging people, I realized that some of the roles that I thought had stayed, it's just that they hadn't updated their LinkedIn yet. And so, you know, like the cuts were more extensive than the impression I originally got from people who'd updated their profiles. But yeah, from what I can sense, and what's been said in the media is that they're keeping these key customer-facing roles in there. They haven't said too much else, but I still see a lot of people that still say in their profile they're working for LM and don't have an open to work banner on them. I still see a lot of like materials expertise, which, I mean, that would be, you would have to be fully insane to to fire, you know, like your chief engineer that knows exactly how, you know, every material has developed at LM and every problem that they had introducing something. I mean, that would be like absolute insanity to fire that whole team. There's still quite a lot in conceptual design in the front end engineering. And so some of the design and analysis people seem to still be there. There is also a little bit still of new technology introduction, but yeah, it seems like most of that is gone as well. And then like all the support roles that, you know, like the VP of marketing is gone, and, you know, like lots of people in the commercial side of things, you know, even really high up are just gone. So it doesn't look like they're kind of wanting to keep the team of people that would enable LM to grow new business and thrive in new markets and develop new technologies. That it seems like it's more of a legacy thing and more kind of just simplified. And I mean, maybe that makes sense to a certain extent. You know, we've all been talking about how you know, we've got all these quality problems at the moment. And my thing that I've been banging on about for the last year or two is that we did go through a period of really rapid technological innovation and, a lot of new technologies developed over a really short time frame and fast and with maybe not enough people and money to do the projects properly. And this isn't talking about LM specifically. This is talking about the whole industry. So I guess, yeah, the response to that is, okay, we'll just do what we do better. But, you know, like the core stuff, we'll focus on that. But if you focus on the core stuff but fire 3/4 of your workforce, then I don't really feel like you have more engineering attention going on to your core products. It feels like even just, you know, maintaining is going to be a stretch based on the number of people that have been fired. So
does GE Vernova limit then the LM production of blades for anybody outside of GE? Is that where this is headed?
My understanding, and I think it's just a rumor, I haven't seen it confirmed anywhere, but my understanding is that LM moving forward will be solely about external customers.
Yeah, I saw that. They're basically saying they were going to focus on them.
So who's going to make all the blades for GE?
Yeah, it's so weird because when GE bought LM, that was the first thing that happened was all of the GE blade design became part of LM. And so, I mean, it could easily have gone the other way that their blade design, that GE's blade design department absorbed LM, even though, you know, like a small fish eating a big one in that case. But you know, they could have done that organizationally. It wouldn't have been surprising at the time. But that was, what, like at least 6 years ago. That was the time to do it. Seems odd that you would spend 6 years doing the opposite and then, try and go back and, like, how much of the GE blade design is still left there and feels culturally GE. It felt reasonably integrated, like not fully integrated, but it felt reasonably integrated when I was, after a few years when I left. So it's hard for me to understand.
Yeah, I don't understand it now because I thought I understood it about a day ago. And now, listening to Rosemary, and thank God she's here, has enlightened me quite a bit. So now I don't even know where Vernova is going in terms of blade design. Are they going to a TPI? Are they going to Aeris? Are they looking internally to GE?
TPI don't design blades. TPI only make blades.
They don't, but maybe they will.
It's right. It's contract manufacturing of the blades that have been already designed. That's part of the workhorse turbine philosophy.
Is there a team within GE that can do it themselves?
Design? Yeah.
Yeah, there was. They used to design their own blades. Before they bought LM, GE designed their own blades and had either LM or TPI make them for them. And then they bought LM, and officially the blade design parts of GE, those people then worked for LM. And I wouldn't say that the cultural change was ever 100%, but it wasn't dysfunctional. You know, it worked roughly. And GE still had some blades made by TPI after that. I don't know how many, if it was many at all, but they wanted to maintain that, you know, that alternative manufacturing source, which is always smart to have two different manufacturing options. I mean, maybe their plan is that they never design another blade. Like, honestly, that's sounding like the most rational interpretation of what they've done, because if you want to focus for now your attention on the blades that you're making, you know, they've got the Haliade and they've got their existing onshore platforms, and just make more of the same for the next 5 years, say, that's fine. That sounds like a good approach to me. But you can't fire every single person that knows how to develop a new blade, a new technology, or you really, you know, in 5 years' time, what's your plan? You can't just go back and get those people again. You know, I could have understand like a 30% trimming if that's what they were going to do, but not 60-70% massacre.
It sounds to me like it could be one of those cases where in a few months you get a lot of people getting callbacks to be a consultant or a contractor at an elevated rate.
No, that's not a GE thing.
No, but if something comes across, like how are you going to address it if you have no talent left? Like,
having worked for GE in the past and been around a lot of GE people pretty much all of my adult life, there is a plan B. Rosemary, come on. You sat through these GE briefings. There's always a plan B. There is a plan in place. You may not know it, but there's a plan in place that's being enacted right now. It's just a question of where's the design going to be made from? Where are they going? Are they going internally?
Yeah. And I mean, it wouldn't have surprised me if some of these roles got moved to GE. So, yeah, I mean, it's funny because, you know, like for the whole time, the last few years that I was working there, it was like really drilled into us. There's no GE and LM anymore. We're all, you know, one company, but now it's really back in the other direction. But yeah, if they want to split GE Vernova into GE onshore, GE offshore and LM blades, then perhaps some of the engineers that have left LM will get roles in GE onshore and offshore. But the funny thing is that I haven't heard that even from the people who have, like, you know, just been informally off the record, you know, telling me what's going on. No one has mentioned, oh, we've been told that, you know, a bunch of us will end up in these two companies. So yeah, I struggled to believe that that's their plan A. I don't know. I can't understand. I guess that there is a plan, but it doesn't make sense to me, and it doesn't make sense to a lot of the workers that have been laid off. I mean, obviously, you never feel good about it, but at least, you know, like when I had the redundancy, they were taking that round of layoffs, and I can't remember the proportion, but the basic things that they were trying to achieve was they wanted to close down the pilot factory that was still at LM, and they wanted to get jobs like mine out of Denmark and into the factories. And I had been saying for the whole past year of my job, maybe 2 years, like my job was so stressful because I really needed to be in the factory all the time. And instead I would do these trips there and, you know, I would go for a week and then something would go wrong and I'd end up there for 2 months. That happened over and over again. And I'm like, this job should be done by someone that lives at the lives at the the location of the factory. So to me, that made sense. It's not nice that they closed down the pilot plant in Denmark, but it is not cheap to run a factory in Denmark compared to all their other locations. It made sense. But this, I can't understand the rationale. And I get the impression that That's the general vibe from people who've been laid off, at least. Obviously, people who are still there are speaking more cautiously and positively about the company. But yeah, it's harder to see the rationale for this one.
It feels like that's exactly what they're doing, though, is they're trying to cut back on an expensive legacy pension and other costs and shift some of their responsibility and labor pool into, you know, other markets. Although that's a bit curious that they would do that and then close down Turkey. But I mean, they're going to be left with, you know, Spain, a little footprint in Brazil, some in the U.S., and certainly China and India. And but with that, I mean, if they're solely going to be focused on customers, those are also markets where they've got a lot more competition these days for making, you know, customer blades. So this is very curious how this ends up playing out.
Yeah, I mean, if you were starting a wind turbine factory or wind turbine manufacturer today, you wouldn't, and you could pick anywhere in the world to start it, you wouldn't choose a high labor country like Denmark. However, when you've got this huge amount of, you know, industrial know-how and just, yeah, the history of the engineering people, because, you know, when you're developing new technologies, most of the way that you do that well is by having people involved that have just seen similar projects go wrong, you know, a lot of them, the more the better. So, you know, we've talked about how, you know, all sorts of things went wrong on the projects that I did. You're like, oh, you know, don't advertise that. But I mean, I will advertise that because that's my most valuable thing, is that I have seen just, you know, project after project after project go wrong in the most ridiculous ways. So then, you know, that helps you for the next one to anticipate what could go wrong and, you know, test for the, you know, common sorts of things early. That's how you get your engineering intuition. And it's not something that you, so though you wouldn't start out in Denmark if you were starting from scratch, once you've got 200-300 engineers with decades of that experience that's really specifically related to the kinds of products that you're going to continue to develop in the future, it's just that you can never replace that. Like, I'm sorry, there's just no, you can't. It's not that engineers in another cheaper labor location are worse. You know, there's good engineers all around the world, and it's not 100% related to the salaries that they're paid, but they just haven't been developing wind turbine technologies for decades, and, you know, cumulatively for hundreds, probably thousands of years when you add up all of the experience of people that were laid off. You just will never replace that. That's lost now.
Lightning is an act of God, but lightning damage is not. Actually, it's very predictable and very preventable. Strike Tape is a lightning protection system upgrade for wind turbines made by WeatherGuard. It dramatically improves the effectiveness of the factory LPS, so you can stop worrying about lightning damage. Visit weatherguardwind.com to learn more, read a case study, and schedule a call today.
Moving on to a less controversial topic, over in the Netherlands, the researchers at TU Delft have been working on a quote-unquote slipper arrangement called Mute Skin, which can reduce the noise from a wind turbine blade by up to 6 dB. 6 dB is a lot. Now, it's made from a permeable foam material, and it attaches to the trailing edge of the blade to dampen the noise. So it's basically a sound absorber kind of device. Field tests on full-scale turbines are underway in partnership with the utility Eneco to validate the noise reduction, right? So what they've done so far is they've been in the wind tunnel and looking at the noise level. And there's some really complicated, intricate ways of measuring noise in the wind tunnel, but then you want to validate it out in real life. That's where they are right now. And as Rosemary is going to point out, we have not seen a picture of this product, just a lot of words. So Rosemary, you want to describe what you think that this thing is?
I really want to see a picture because it's impossible to say if it's genius or rubbish. You know, it could be either of those two extremes. Probably, it's probably not in the middle. You know, it's probably one of those two things. I want to start by saying that, you know, noise is a real problem. So, you know, they've got a real problem that they're trying to solve. It's it's a design constraint. When you're designing a wind turbine, usually you've got a certain noise limit that you have to make sure that your turbine is quieter than that. And the main way that they control that is by having the tip speed limited. So the faster that the tip of the blade is going, the noisier it is in general. So if no one cared about noise, probably wind turbines would spin a bit faster. And then you could have a more slender blade, which helps with, you know, keeping blades narrower and lighter and less extreme forces when they, you know, get hit by a gust of wind. So everyone would like to make blades rotate faster, and noise is one of the main reasons why they don't. So yeah, they're definitely pursuing a problem that everyone would like to see improved, but it's already got a lot of focus on it, this area. It's certainly not true that nobody has done any work on trying to make wind turbines quieter. You know, there's already I used to work with a guy who was doing his PhD on the acoustics of wind turbine blades. So, you know, like that's it's a field and people are pursuing it.
Serrations of other sorts?
They add these, like they try and mimic how an owl, you know, owls fly very quietly, and they've got these, you know, long feathers on their wings. And my understanding is it's not fully understood, actually, the phenomenon of why they're so quiet, but they do add these feathers or whatever you want to call them. I'm sure people call them different things, just like plastic feathery things that go on the trailing edge at the tip so that they make the blade quieter. And then also, you know, the aerodynamic profile of the blade as well. That's something else that that is designed with noise in mind. I remember one time working on a blade where, we got a profile from the customer and it looked a bit funny and you're like, and I remember the LM engineer saying, that's going to be noisy. Like, have they tested that? And in fact, when the blades got made and the turbines got installed, it was noise was a problem and they had to, scramble to fix that. So, you know, noise is something that people are thinking about a lot. So welcome a technology that will improve that. But yeah, without having seen it, it's hard to say for sure. But when I hear soft foam, that sort of thing, I think not durable.
Ice.
Yeah. So I don't know how much they've tested it. They're obviously intentionally not showing a photo, right? They must not be able to patent it. Otherwise, there would be nothing wrong with sharing it. So they're worried about being copied. But I mean, once they install one of these to a third-party customer, someone's going to take a photo of that and share it. And then if it's so good and so easy to copy, then every manufacturer is just going to make their own version. So, you know, I would be worried about that if I were them. It feels like a premature press release, like you were saying, Joel. Like, if they're really so scared to show it, like, should they really be talking about it? I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. It's the same thing when I read it and I see permeable foam, I think that's not going to last on a blade. I don't know what it is, right? And immediately, and this is why I said this earlier, Phil, my mind goes to like the injection molded croc. And then they're like, oh, it's a blade slipper. And I'm like, it is a croc that goes on the blade somehow. I don't know. That's not true. But it's just what comes into my mind. So I'm thinking about some of that permeable foam material. Like, okay, so WeatherGuard, right, from our Strike Tape product, we've been on this tour all week talking to every O&M building and asset manager we can. And we're talking consistently about how we're installed and how it's for longevity and durability of the product and the blade. Because any blade add-on is only as good as its installation. And so if you can't install it well or the materials aren't designed well, if it doesn't last, what's the point? And I'm not saying this doesn't last whatsoever. I'm just saying when I hear permeable foam, I think, I don't know about that.
And keep in mind, too, serrated trailing edges were first thought up back in the 70s for not only aerospace applications, but there was also a patent for serrated trailing edge on a wind turbine back in, I want to say, like 72 or something like that. So this is not necessarily a new idea. There was a point in time, and I want to say it was around 2008, 2009, when there were a ton of patents filed on noise mitigation technologies by GE and Joel, you mentioned, you know, some by Siemens and et cetera. The thing is, all of these designs were investigated, including this kind of permeable foam type of structure. So one wonders if they've got an improvement on something that was previously developed and they can actually make it commercially viable, then that's interesting and compelling. But a lot of these, and this happens a lot more so in the US than with these European research facilities, but people invent or think they've invented something that's actually already been done or already been investigated by, you know, these for-profit corporations that have a vested interest in having the latest and greatest technology available. So again, I hope that this can come to fruition as a product, but we'll see.
Show us a picture.
Yeah, right. I mean, if it's truly meant to be something, you got to explain what it is. You know, hopefully they've got their patent in place that they, because if you've got it filed, then you've got protection. If they don't have the patent filed yet, then you're right. Then it's a premature press release.
It could be like, I think it was Rosemary, you were telling us about a book of just different wind turbine models that have been explored and experimented and investigated for the last 50 years, whatever. People are like, we've got this new idea and it's going to change the way wind is. Like, that was done in the 60s or the 80s or whatever.
Yeah, I've never, you know, people suggest new ideas for wind to me all the time, and there's new companies springing up all the time with new wind turbine ideas. And I have never, since I bought this book like 2 or 3 years ago, and it's from the 80s, I think, I have never come across a technology that I could not find in that book. It, you know, it's like everything is in there. That, you know, that clothesline kind of wind turbine that Bill Gates invested in, that's in there. Airborne wind, which we're probably, or maybe we won't get to it today, but there's been some news with airborne wind recently, that's in there. Vertical axis, obviously, in there. You know, any kind of way that you could think of to harvest energy from the wind, it has been thought of. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's no reason to develop those as, you know, like our needs change, materials change, controls, technologies have changed. So you can revisit, but it does make it hard. You can't patent an idea that's that old and that public, right? So it makes it harder for business.
Does it matter if it's patentable? I think this is the misconception.
It does if it's easy to copy. If you would just show a picture of this mute skin slipper, if you would show a picture of that, and that would be enough to, you know, give away your clever idea to you know, manufacturers, and you're worried about them reproducing it themselves. I mean, yeah, if you can look at a picture of it and then just make it, or even, you know, someone's going to get their hands on it. They're going to be able to feel it and test it. That will happen once it's, you know, selling to external customers. They can do what they want with it once they've bought it, including give it to GE or Vestas or whoever to reverse engineer it. If it's not patentable, then that is totally legal.
I'm going to give you the Elon response to that, Rosemary, which is Tesla just releases all of its patents for the cars and just turns them loose. And guess what? It doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference.
Because it's not easy to copy. It's not easy to copy what they've ended up with.
Yeah, but they've also developed certain, it's like Apple with some of the proprietary connectors. And now in Europe, they're being forced to switch over like the Thunderbolt connector to a USB-C connector. It's, you know, there are still reasons. Even if you open up the IP, it's the level of investment that's required to replicate it that is going to end up determining whether or not you're going to get copied. But the key to this is, like we've been talking about, anybody that has invented anything over the years, there's always going to be somebody that's invented something kind of similar already, especially if you're this far into the maturity of an industry like wind energy. The reality of it, though, like you just said, if we're maturing a concept that was not commercially viable before with new material science that makes that possible. I mean, we see this all the time in aerospace, you know, like the supercritical wing airfoil shape that nobody can ever build because, you know, even though it's the most aerodynamically efficient thing, you know, it's too, like, you're never going to be able to house the fuel inside the wing anymore. You can't actually build the supercritical wing. It's the same kind of thing in wind, that we've got a lot of technologies that have been proposed that we don't have a commercially viable way of bringing it to fruition. You know, so it's, you're going to get up to a TRL 5 and then stop. You're not going to get it to a TRL 9, and then it's available for everybody.
I think the key for any sort of new innovation is you have to get it out in the marketplace very quickly and dominate the marketplace. You may have somebody copy you, but if you're the idea leader in that space, it's very hard for someone to take that over. And I think Tesla's a good example of that. So I'm kind of with Rosemary on this. It could, and that's just shocking to say, actually. I'm shocked to hear it myself, but it's either going to be completely wonderful or going to have a hard, really hard time. There's not going to be a lot of in between here.
We just got to see it, though. I would really love to have those guys on the show. We'll do a special episode and hear their side of it, because obviously they think that they've got something that's worth pursuing that isn't, you know, in danger of immediately being copied by everybody as soon as they sell one. So I'd love to hear more about it, because if it does work, then that's, you know, that has implications for wind turbine design. We can make them the whole turbine a little bit more efficient, a little bit cheaper.
So everybody involved in MuteSkin, because it is a separate company, you can just reach Rosemary. Just go to pardalote.com and send them a note. That'll get right to Rosemary and she'll set up an interview.
Hey, Uptime listeners. We know how difficult it is to keep track of the wind industry. That's why we read PES Wind Magazine. PES Wind doesn't summarize the news. It digs into the tough issues. And PES Wind is written by the experts, so you can get the in-depth info you need. Check out the wind industry's leading trade publication, PES Wind, at peswind.com.
As Joel and I have wandered around most of Texas over the last week, what we've noticed, there's a lack of technicians. And we've talked to a number of technical training schools in the last several days, and that has been eye-opening. Well, here comes the news about the lack of skilled welders. The U.S. is really in trouble in terms of manufacturing and infrastructure and clean energy projects, because there's just not enough welders around to do those projects. The supply of welders, if you've been following that, has been shrinking for several years. In fact, there's a lot of job postings. If you look online, there's a lot of job postings right now for welders, and they're willing to pay them a lot of money if you're a good welder. But the shortage now is estimated to be over 300,000. That's a lot of people that really need to learn how to weld, and that's going to accumulate over the next 4 years. So what has historically been seen as sort of maybe a dead-end job in some people's minds, that thing, you're going to earn $100,000 being a welder. And Joel, as you and I have done a lot of work on this in the last week or so, where are young people or old people like me, I guess, going to learn how to weld so that we can do these jobs? Where does that happen at now? It used to happen in high schools.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's really interesting being in West Texas, right? Alan and I, of course, stopping at training facilities, stopping at O&M shops, but we're driving around West Texas in the truck, talking to each other. We have had lengthy conversations about the state of our nation and education for the youth and all kinds of good things. But we're in a special place, right? The West Texas is where the Permian Basin is and a bunch of other shale formations. So it's heavy oil field. We've been driving through the oil field for the last few days. The oil field out here is also the wind field, right? It's the same thing. They coexist. So you see all these welding trucks running around here from my oil and gas past, also pipelines being put in. I know that those pickups that have the welding machines in the back of them out here, The truck itself, you're getting $100 and $150 a day for, plus per diem. And those guys are making crazy hourly wages. Some of them have an apprentice with them. Some of them don't. Some of those welders that are working on pipelines, because specifically they're in higher and higher demand, those guys are making $150,000, $200,000 a year traveling around welding up pipelines. So it's in very high demand. I mean, there is schools, right? I learned how to weld in high school. Now, I'm not going to say I'm a good welder. We also had this conversation. my first TIG weld that I thought was professional, the guy who inspected it for me said, "You're getting a grinder for Christmas." So, same thing about me tying knots. I'm not a good knot tier. So you can't tie a good knot. You tie a lot of knots. It's my same theory with welding. So I'm not the one you want to call when you need something welded. It's not going to be pretty. But there is, you know, we talked about earlier on the show, we talked about UTI. That's actually a huge welding school. So there is these technical schools out there that are teaching just welding programs. to get youth involved in them. But it's kind of the same thing we're seeing in the wind industry, in all these training academies and community colleges and stuff. There's a reaction to the lack of technicians. So the reaction is, hey, we have this thing. So it's been visible now. We have this shortage. So now you're starting to see more and more of these schools and training facilities and stuff popping up. But also at the same time, when you talk to those schools, getting new net capacity into those schools is tough. They're having a hard time finding young adults, young people out of high school, career transitioning, men and women coming out of the military, or, you know, you might be 40 years old and need a new career. But they're having a hard, that those are easier to find to bring people in, but they're having a hard time getting new net capacity into some of these more vocational schools here in the States, which I don't understand, because if you look at the writing on the wall, plumbers are retiring, HVAC technicians are retiring, electricians are retiring, welders are retiring, that there's nobody to replace these people. So we need all of these skilled labor individuals. Welders being a very, very skilled labor, right? There's a lot more to it than sparking an arc and running a bead. There's so much more to welding, and I can tell you that because I'm not very good at it. So it's like I said, with Alan and I doing this trip through Texas the last week, you've seen a lot of projects going on all over the place. Everywhere you turn your head, there's something happening out here in West Texas, whether it's building a wind farm or welding up a pipeline. So these jobs are out there. We just have to find the people to fill them and get the training to go out and do them.
And you notice most recently with the online advertising that's plastered everywhere. I see it on television. I've seen it on race cars. Buildsubmarines.com, right? That they're having a hard time finding skilled workers to build submarines. And I did go to that website. And if you're interested, you can go to buildsubmarines.com and take a look. I think the last time I checked, they had almost 200 pages of job postings for skilled workers. That's how bad it's gotten, is that they're trying to advertise their way into finding workers for critical things like submarines that we will send to Australia. But, you know, it does show you, Joel, that there is a lot of demand for skilled workers, and those jobs pay more than desk jobs in a lot of cases. And there is a skilled workforce need. And this is just highlighting it. And as we go around Texas a little bit more and travel to other training facilities, we're going to highlight this. This is important for the wind industry and for everybody's economy around the world. You need skilled workers.
Yeah, TikTok and ChatGPT are not going to solve the skilled trades issues that we've got across the world. So while everybody's enthusiastic about tech, the reality is skilled trades are a necessary part of actually attracting foreign direct investment as well. Because, you know, we talked before on the show about companies wanting to set up factories in Australia, for example, for wind energy component production. But they can't do it because they have a lack of skilled engineers and skilled tradespeople there that would be capable of, you know, providing the necessary, jobs and support that companies are going to need to be able to produce anything at scale. So they're having to depend on, you know, Malaysia, Indonesia, China, Vietnam for a lot of the component imports, as opposed to having a significant base of domestic production there. So, you know, anytime you want to talk about an IRA bill or, you know, in Europe now, we've got this whole malaise of countervailing duties against China and all that. The reality is, if you're not creating an environment where skilled tradespeople are going to thrive, you're going to end up losing, because you can't just shift your entire economy to a tech economy and think you're going to be fine. The stuff breaks and needs to be fixed. And if we don't have people that know how to do that, we are going to lose. We're going to fail.
It's Alan, it's a conversation you and I had in the truck today. There's a foundational issue there within the culture in a lot of advanced countries where people don't want to work with their hands anymore. And it's going to be a downfall.
That's going to do it for this week's Uptime Wind Energy podcast. Thanks for listening. And please take a moment and give us a 5-star rating on your podcast platform. Be sure to subscribe in the show notes below to Uptime Tech News. Please subscribe to Uptime Tech News, our weekly newsletter. It's free. And so is Rosemary's YouTube channel, Engineering with Rosie. It's free. And we'll see you here next week on the Uptime Wind Energy podcast.